Hello everyone, I'm Harry Bucknell. Thank you for downloading this special podcast produced by ABF, the Soldiers' Charity, a tribute to the men and women of our armed forces, the Merchant Navy and local employed personnel on board ship who fought in the Falklands conflict or Operation Corporate to liberate the remote British Overseas Territory in the South Atlantic 40 years ago.
Right, well, His Excellency the Governor is on the line now, and he's going to speak to you before we have to play the Argentine tapes. Yes, sir, go ahead, please.
Hello, Countess and Islanders. I hope that you can hear me on the phone. The machine here doesn't work. Admiral came along to me, and I told him that he'd landed unlawfully on British sovereign territory, and I ordered him to leave forthwith. He refused, claiming that he was taking back territory that belonged to Argentina, and it was I said that it was reprehensible that Argentina should have seized the islands by force after Britain and Argentina had agreed in the UN to settle the dispute by peaceful means. He said he was a soldier merely obeying instructions, and he appealed to me to cease needless bloodshed as he had an overwhelmingly superior force. I said I couldn't argue with that, but I would not have agreed to a ceasefire had we had anything like comparable forces. He paid tribute to our troops and called them very brave. That's all I got to say. I'm sorry it's happened this way. It's probably the last message I'll be able to give you. But I wish you all the best of luck. Rest assured that the British will be back.
Rest assured the British will be back. The final message of Governor Sir Rex Hunt, made on the Falkland Islands broadcasting station following the invasion of the British Overseas Territory by Argentine forces on the 2nd of April, 1982. The response by the Right Honourable Margaret Thatcher, still in her first term as Prime Minister, was swift, resolute and unwavering.
Prime Minister!
Mr. Speaker, sir, the House meets this Saturday to respond to a situation of great gravity. We are here because for the first time for many years, British sovereign territory has been invaded by a foreign power. After several days of rising tension in our relations with Argentina, that country's armed forces attacked the Falkland Islands yesterday and established military control of the islands. Mr. Speaker, diplomatic efforts are more likely to succeed if they are backed by military strength. At 5 a.m. London time on Monday the 12th of April, the maritime exclusion zone of 200 miles around the Falkland Islands came into effect. From that time, any Argentine warships and Argentine naval auxiliaries found within this zone are treated as hostile and are liable to be attacked by British forces. We see this measure as the first step towards achieving the withdrawal of Argentine forces. If the zone is challenged, we shall take that as the clearest evidence that the search for a peaceful solution has been abandoned. We shall then take the necessary action. Let no one doubt that.
Mobilisation was ordered within moments of the invasion of the islands, some 7,000 miles distance being reported. First Sea Lord Admiral Sir John Fieldhouse was placed in command of Force 317, as the task force was known. The amphibious element, formed of two carrier groups supported by ships taken up from trade, such as the liner SS Canberra and Uganda, converted to a hospital ship, plus container vessels like the Atlantic Conveyor, was commanded by Admiral Sir Sandy Woodward. While the land element, commanded by Major General Sir Jeremy Moore, consisted of Brigadier Julian Thompson's bolstered 3 Commando Brigade, with 4-2 and 4-5 commandos, the 2nd and 3rd Battalions of the Parachute Regiment, and a half squadron of the Blues and Royals. Following on, aboard the QE2, came Brigadier Tony Wilson's 5 Brigade, with 1st Battalion 7th Gurkha Rifles, 2nd Battalion of the Scots Guards, and 1st Battalion of the Welsh Guards. Within a week, the lead elements, including 3 Commando Brigade, were on their way south.
The Naval Task Force is proceeding with all speed towards the South Atlantic. It's a formidable force, comprising two aircraft carriers, five guided missile destroyers, seven frigates, an assault ship with five landing ships, together with supporting vessels. The composition of the force and the speed with which it was assembled and put to sea clearly demonstrate our determination.
Denzel Connick, then a 25-year-old Lance Corporal in the ice tank platoon with three para.
We were in Tidworth, in Kandahar Barracks at the time, and indeed we were also the spearhead battalion at that very moment. And of course it was Easter leave time as well, and about half the battalion were on Easter leave. The other half were kept sort of close to barracks, our briefings at the time, of course, the intelligence briefings that we had then was typically for Northern Ireland and possible other hotspots. Not a single mention, of course, of the Falkland Islands. Right. And when we got the news that we were to return to barracks as quickly as possible with the code word Kandahar, which was displayed around railway stations and bus stations and so on up and down the country. And we were all saying, where the hell is this place called the Falkland Islands? You know?
Mark Corrith, then a 23-year-old lieutenant and troop leader with the Blues and Roars, an armoured recce regiment equipped with a CVRT, stationed at the time in Windsor.
But, you know, and it happened so unbelievably quickly. That was 2nd of April. We were sailing on the 9th aboard Canberra.
Colonel Tim Spicer, then a captain and operations officer of 2nd Battalion Scots Guards, stationed in Chelsea Barracks.
I was the captain of the guard at the Tower of London. And it's not uppermost in your mind that you might be about to go to war when you're the captain of the guard of the Tower of London. But after that, we dismounted. I think it was a Saturday, but I'm pretty sure it was a Saturday. Got back into barracks and there were people running everywhere, and somebody came and put their feet in and said, Connie Oss would like to see you in the orderly room. So that's how it started.
Robert Fox, now the Evening Standard's veteran defence correspondent, was then a radio reporter for BBC News.
The BBC at that time, where I was not prepared for anything. And how I departed, there was the debate in the House of Commons that Saturday, and I went down to Portsmouth overnight, Sunday, Monday, to see the Fearless and Hermes and Invincible depart with lots of things on its deck. There were lots of Royal Marines running up and down to Hermes, and they were getting LSLs ready. And it took a week to get together before the Commando Brigade, plus the two parachute regiment battalions, to set forth. They were very, very well run, the Commando Brigade. Julian Thompson had his headquarters in Fearless, the landing platform dot, along with Intrepid. They were very, very important, although they looked like light World War II cruisers. It was a very coherent outfit. And I must say that in Canberra, we had 40 and 4-2 commando and three para. And all things said and done, they got on very, very well indeed. And I think that the para officers, for all the munching and chomping, particularly then Colonel Hugh Pike and Colonel H. Jones, now General Pike, of course, actually they got on very, very well with Julian Thompson and his team. And may I say, as I look back on it, 40 years, I think they really were very, very good indeed, and almost exceptional.
While US Secretary of State, former General Al Haig, shuttlecocked back and forth with an embryonic peace plan, on the 25th of April, South Georgia, 870 miles east of the Falklands, was liberated. Defence Secretary Sir John Nott.
The commander of the operation has sent the following message. Be pleased to inform Her Majesty that the White Ensign flies alongside the Union Jack in South Georgia. God save the Queen.
What happens next, Mr. Knott?
Thank you very much.
What's your reaction?
Just rejoice at that news and congratulate our forces and the Marines.
5 days later, Vulcan bombers of the Royal Air Force will begin the first of a series of Operation Black Bucks, the bombing of Stanley Airfield. By the end of April, foreign reports on the activities of the Argentinian aircraft carrier 25 de Mayo in the north, the light cruiser Belgrano to the southwest, Admiral Woodward concluded that the Argentinian Navy was manoeuvring prior to attack. On the 2nd of May, Naval Fleet Command at Northwood gave HMS Conqueror, the 5,000-ton Churchill-class nuclear-powered submarine, permission to engage the Argentinian warship. Firing 3 Mark 8 torpedoes, the vessel sank in 20 minutes. The Argentinian Navy played no major role in the rest of the conflict.
Tim Spicer.
Well, much later, I had this very conversation with Mrs. Thatcher, Lady Thatcher as she then was, and I said I, for one, was extremely glad that it was sunk. I don't subscribe to the fact that it wasn't a threat. The thing could steam quite fast. It had a massive amount of firepower. A broadside from the Belgrano would have sunk the QE2 and taken out 5 Brigade in one go. So if you're conducting a maritime operation, an invasion over long lines of maritime communications, and you've got a battleship, even if it's an old-fashioned battleship, but with bloody great guns on it, you want it out of the way. So I was delighted.
What did she say?
Well, she said, I'm very glad you agree, young man.
With the Argentine Navy effectively removed from the conflict, the greatest threat was the skill, bravery and determination of the Argentine Air Force, who pressed home courageous attacks on the task force in Mirage and Skyhawk jets, using £1,000 British bombs and Exocet missiles. Losses would be heavy, especially in San Carlos Water, or Bomb Alley, as it was affectionately known, costing the Royal Navy 2 destroyers and 2 frigates, and later a Royal Fleet auxiliary and a vital supply ship. Ministry of Defence spokesman Ian MacDonald announces the loss of the destroyer HMS Sheffield on the 10th of May.
In the course of its duties within the total exclusion zone around the Falkland Islands, HMS Sheffield, a Type 42 destroyer, was attacked and hit late this afternoon by an Argentine missile.
Robert Fox.
But by golly, on the 21st of May, there was a little bit of the Nelson touch. I mean, what Admiral West, and then he was Commander West, did with our, he stood in the line and took the fire so that the troops, with Dave and Pat Bishop and myself were among, could get ashore, because we knew, all of us, even us civvies knew, there was little to be had in terms of air cover.
As the recce officer, I was in the first first Gazelle helicopter that took off at HR on D-Day. Sadly and unknown to me, the next two were shot down. And then other recce officers came on after that. And then my guns were in the first wave of Sea Kings to land, and we landed at San Carlos, which was all a pretty exciting thing, and nobody knew what to expect.
Peter Bates, a 23-year-old subaltern or lieutenant, a gun position officer with 7.9 Kirky Commando Battery, equipped with 105mm light guns, part of 2.9 Commando Regiment, Royal Artillery.
We were about as sharp as you could be on Bomb Alley. We could see the sound where the ships were unloading. And of course, that was prime target for the Argentinian Air Force. So within the first day, we suffered our first air attacks. The excitement, if you've never had an air attack go over your head, is quite unbelievable. The fire mission came in actually to a different battery to take out the machine gun that had been busy taking out our Gazelle helicopters. I knew it wasn't for me, but I still got our guns to lay on the target, report ready, which we did before the others were ready. again, a massive, slightly immature but very proud moment, because they then gave the fire mission to us, and we fired, we destroyed the target.
Major General Chip Chapman, then commanding 6th Platoon, B Company, 2nd Battalion, the Parachute Regiment.
From the time we landed, and we, of course, had to wade ashore, you were getting no respite from the weather and the climate and the elements. And it was that that was having a deteriorating effect on the force. We really needed to get on. So by day three, D plus two, I'd lost one of my soldiers with something akin to trench foot. And we never saw him again for the remainder of the war.
On the 23rd of May, we're on an air defence station at the entrance to San Carlos Water. HMS Antelope, a Type 21 frigate, was attacked by four Argentinian Skyhawks led by Captain Pablo Carbello. Despite putting up a courageous fight, Antelope was stricken by two 1,000-pound bombs, the first lodged in the petty officer's mess and the second in the refrigerator. Major John Phillips, then a Warrant Officer Class 2 Explosive Ordnance Disposal Expert in the Royal Engineers, and his comrade, Staff Sergeant Jim Prescott, had not been on a warship until the bomb-damaged HMS Argonaut the day before. Here, he picks up the story of the bomb in Antelope's refrigerator.
When we arrived on board HMS Antelope, we were shown the location of the two bombs. It was exactly the same as we dealt with the day before, a 1,000-pound general-purpose bomb, British. We knew the fusing mechanisms or the pistol involved, and we had the right kit to deal with it, so we asked the captain to get his crew out of the ship onto the decks as best he could. Obviously, there were critical positions that still had to be manned, but the majority of the crew were up on the decks. And then we set to work trying to extract the pistol from the bomb. And whereas it was straightforward the day before and came out straight away, this time it didn't, because the pistol was slightly damaged. So we set up our rocket wrench, is what it's called, the equipment, and it works like a Catherine wheel, unscrewing it. So we had a third attempt. Each time I was retiring to a relatively safe distance, and there isn't a safe distance on board a ship, to be honest with you, closing the bulkhead doors between us and it before I actually pressed the tip to fire the rocket wrench. And this time, when I fired it for the third time, took the cables out as I did before, prepared to go forward to inspect, and there was a huge explosion. Jim and I had milliseconds. We looked at each other in the eye because Jim was standing right next to me. And it wasn't expected, of course. And then there was this all right, almighty rush. And I describe it as two fast trains passing each other, where you get that buildup of pressure and yeah. You get that woof. That's exactly what the sensation was. And the next thing I know, I'm flying through the air. And it seemed like I was flying through the air for several seconds. But it must have been only be a millisecond or a half a second or what. And I was going down this long tunnel, this proverbial tunnel with a bright light on the end, a blue sky and a green grass. And there was a silhouette of my father at the end, who had died a few years before. And he was waiting for me. And I was thinking, oh, well, I was calm. I wasn't thinking of family. I had no pain. It was serene, really. I was floating down this tunnel and all of a sudden, bang, I never got the end. I hit the bulkhead. And which brought me back to my senses. And then I fell to the floor. Now I knew my arm had been damaged. And I felt around to see if my legs had been damaged. And I stood up expecting pain from broken legs or whatever, and there wasn't any. So my next instinct was to try and find Jim to look around, because by now the ship was on fire. There was a lot of smoke around and I was in a strange environment. I didn't really know how to get out. And next thing I know, as a petty officer, I now know to be a petty officer, came down, put his hand on my shoulder and said, "Jim's dead, follow me." So I put my hand on his shoulder and followed him through the smoke. And we had to pass Jim Prescott on the way to the escape hatch. And Jim was just lying on his back with his glasses on. No signs of any damage at all, which helped me when I wrote to his mother after we got home. But I got to the escape hatch and we escaped onto the flight deck where the rest of the crew were under my instructions to get up out of the ship. And after a while, the fire became out of control. And Nick Tobin gave the order to abandon ship. And I abandoned ship with the rest of the crew into landing craft Foxtrot 4. And by then I was on a stretcher, although I climbed over the side myself, clinging onto my arm because I knew my arm was damaged. And they put me on a stretcher because shock was beginning to take in. You know, I was beginning to get cold and shaking. And I lay on the stretcher watching the aluminium from the ship burning, floating down like burning paper. It was incredible. And they kept counting the crew because they wanted to make sure they got everybody off the ship before they pulled away. And I'm lying there thinking, if we don't move away from this ship soon, there's going to be another explosion. We did pull away eventually on our way to Ajax Bay, which was the field hospital that Rick Jolly had set up. And halfway to Ajax Bay, the second explosion, which I expected, occurred.
Of all the losses the fleet would suffer, most devastating and far-reaching would be the SS Atlantic Conveyor. Under the command of ship's master, Captain Ian North, a proud Yorkshireman and an old sea dog who played the trombone late of a night and had been twice sunk in the Second World War. On the 25th of May, hit by two Exocet missiles, the 15,000-ton container vessel was lost with 12 hands, including the brave Captain North himself. Mark Corrith.
Bluntly, the Atlantic Conveyor going down was catastrophic from the big logistical picture. From our point of view, it had a spare vehicle on, it had all our, the majority of our final drives and all the spares that we were planning, thought we might be needing. It had a lot of ammunition on board. It had the helicopters, the Chinook helicopters that were lost. They were the things that were going to be, in theory, pillboxing us from one place to another. So it's, you know, then there was just that one helicopter remaining.
On East Falkland, Chip Chapman picks up the events leading to Goose Green.
There were a number of false starts for Goose Green politicians, particularly after the 25th of May and the sinking of the Atlantic Conveyor and the Coventry on that day. We're getting very jittery about parliamentary morale beginning to collapse after the halcyon moments of the landing, and that they needed for Thompson and three commando brigade to get on. Otherwise, calls for a ceasefire would have been amplified and they wouldn't have achieved their strategic objectives. There were two major points to make. You know, throughout history, we know that an attacking force should have an advantage of 3-1 over the enemy. We didn't have that. It also doesn't take the brains of an archbishop to work out that having only a troop, three artillery pieces to do a battalion attack against a dug-in enemy is not really an act of war. So we were not given the artillery resources. We were not given the manpower resources. We were not given the air resources, but I understand why. But what we weren't short of was raw courage from the Toms, who went forward and took the enemy positions, and they did it not for the Queen. They didn't do it for the Falkland Islanders. They didn't do it for Maggie Thatcher. They did it for each other.
And the fleet had one imperative, as Woodward said, which was to preserve the carrier group. If he'd lost one or even both of those carriers, it would have been very, very difficult, perhaps terminal.
All the company commanders were first rate. I mean, my company commander was John Crossland, and he was a charismatic leader. I mean, we would have walked over a cliff if he'd told us to do so. Such was his rapport and understanding and leadership of the blokes. He never wore a helmet. He just wore a black hat. we thought that he was not only legendary, but fearless. And as long as he was alive, we always believed that we would survive.
BBC News correspondent Robert Fox, embedded with two para.
But somebody had leaked after a war cabinet meeting that a parachute battalion was already engaged in battle. And H and I talked about it, and I said, well, I'm a bit, I can put it like this, regretful. Now, actually, I was very angry. That had thrown H, and he sent a runner, which was very odd, H, and absolutely old-fashioned, and the really extraordinary old-fashioned, decent side of him. And he said, I want to make it, the runner said, the colonel says he wants to make it absolutely plain to you, Mr. Fox, that he does not hold you responsible for this slip-up by the BBC in any way at all, and hopes you will join him in the battle tomorrow. I mean, that could have been before Balaclava, couldn't it? Yeah. He did ask me to go with him. And I think about this again and again, with his tack, with Barry Norman, the sergeant. And I hadn't been in a formal set piece battle, not that it was formal or particularly set piece, but I did not trust myself. I did not know how I would handle myself in those circumstances. And I declined and said I would go with the battalion main, which was behind the two front companies, with Chris Keeble. And had I gone with H. Jones, I'm pretty sure I would have been killed.
Chip Chapman.
Well, the plan was for a six-phase operation, which was quite mechanistic in lots of ways. So phase one would start at 6 in the morning, phase two, 7 in the morning, phase three, 8 in the morning, things like that. And most of it would take place in the dark. And we would have tin medals by first light in terms of the construct of the timeline. So it was constructed really so that you would bite a Argentinian position, hold that, another company would then bite somewhere else, you'd hold that, and then repeat really was the way it happened. By the time I got my orders and was able to go back and give my orders to the blokes, it wasn't six phases at all. It was, we got about 3 minutes before we move. There's some enemy to our front. We'll treat this as a advance to contact. Anyone who gets in the way, we'll get rid of them. And we'll finish when we get to Goose Green. Sixth Platoon were the first platoon in contact with live enemy at a place called Low Pass, which was a odd contact because we'd been told we'd be going across the best arable ground in the Falklands. And I thought, well, if we're going across arable ground, there might be a few cabbage fields and carrots and things like that. And so we were advancing very, very dark. It was 2:30 in the morning when we started. And someone said, watch out, there's a scarecrow in front. Now, cognitively, I believe that that could be true because of my carrots and turnip fields and things. But it actually was an enemy soldier coming towards us. He was dispatched, that led to a platoon attack with a number of enemy positions behind that. The atmosphere was then electric. And really from that moment on, I believed that we would win this war. We would certainly win this battle and that we were invincible as a force going forward. So we finished that first contact and were sort of shelled in the vicinity of the area we were. I think you have to remember how tired we were because we really had no sleep for 72 hours and we didn't have any sleeping bags and things like that. Time just flashed by during the entire battle. And I have no idea of what the time was at any time, apart from to say to me, the entire battle is divided between the time it was dark and the time it was light. We were hugely successful when it was dark, but we're getting into all sorts of trouble when it was light because the advantage sort of switched to the enemy in a way. Goose Green really falls into two battles in my view. There's the battle prior to the Gorse Line, and there's the battle post the Gorse Line. The battle pre the Gorse Line is Colonel Jones's battle. The battle post the Gorse Line is Colonel Keeble's battle, Major Keeble as he was then. And everything post the Gorse Line is completely different in terms of what we did and didn't follow the orders at all. The orders go for a ball of chalk after the gorse line.
It was the combination of Crossland, Neame, Farrow Hockley, and Hector Gullen, Hector the corrector. They sort of had a plan ready to put to Chris, and Chris could see exactly what had to be done with that. And they went forward at huge risk, I realised, because C Company went straight down towards the absolutely strategic schoolhouse, which lay outside the settlement itself, in broad daylight, over something, as I said, rather like a golf course. And that's where the fighting was done. But it was really a decisive move. A Company was in a holding position and held Darwin and the hill, but you hooking round to the right, you got Johnny Crossland's B Company and Phil Neame's D Company. And it was those two pushing each other along, and they got really close to the settlement. They got too close to the settlement. I suspect they could see the Argentines, and the Argentines could see them. But it really was, as you say, the regeneration of the momentum. And somehow in the middle of that afternoon, one felt physically that the initiative was passing. Because actually it had no business to, because when you looked at the position of the Argentines, they had this defensive, natural defensive wall called the Gorse Line, which was alight at this time, was burning, beginning to burn fiercely by the time H. Jones was killed. And they should have held that position. They had the strength, they had the firepower. But when you looked at their firing arcs, they were hopeless. They were absolutely hopeless. Although Chris did prevail, Chris Keeble, and they did get the Harriers in at the end. And once the Harriers came in, and it was well close to last light, and that stopped things for the night.
But by last light, exhausted and desperately low on ammunition, the situation for Tupara was critical. Major Chris Keeble messaged the enemy force and demanded their surrender or face the consequences. He called their bluff. It was a ploy that worked. Robert Fox.
It was one of the most completely professional military outfits I've ever worked with.
After the battle, I think everyone believed, because the sort of ruse that Chris Keeble achieved to get the enemy to surrender, that this was a great victory by Chris Keeble. So what the thing which really occurred was the fact that we were quite upset that Keeble, having engineered the success at Goose Green, was then usurped in a way by bringing in Colonel Chandler. So in my view, of course, you have to look at the whole war from a two-power perspective, in the fact that we actually had three commanding officers, one, not two, but three. Of course, the only unit which had three commanding officers. And I think what was quite interesting in terms of when Colonel Chandler took over, because he really came and met the battalion really when we got to Fitzroy around the 8th of June. He had come to Goose Green, but we were already moving on by then and didn't see him. And we were a bit skeptical about him, but it was a stunning display of leadership that he actually achieved. He brought the papers from England and showed how they were showing the magnificence of Tupara at Goose Green. So he played to our ego. And then he said, and if you are committed to another battle again, I will ensure that you have all the resources to fight a true all-arms battle. And he was true to his word at the Battle of Wireless Ridge, where we had more artillery than you could shake a stick at, and the CVRT of the Blues and Royals to fight the best all-arms battle of the Falklands. So he had us in the palm of his hand, and he lived up to the contract that he delivered to us.
Mark Corrith, commanding the half squadron of the Blues and Royals Armoured Recce Regiment.
Julian Thompson was not prepared to risk us on a trip down to Darwin and Goose Green. It was he did admit to me later that it was a huge error, because we would have changed that battle completely. We had two Scorpions with 76mm, two Scimitars with 30mm, and we had two troops of that combination. We could have changed that battle completely. It was a sadness we weren't allowed to do it. We might have been taken out by Picaro. Who knows? But you know, that's the normal course of battle. But I suspect there would have not been a loss of a commanding officer and adjutant and all that jazz. Where they got bogged down, we would have gone in. We would have knocked those machine gun posts out at the drop of a hat. Julian Thompson afterwards said very clearly to me that he had made, that was an error that he had made. It is a judgment, but a judgment based on understandable misunderstanding.
But the soldiers who would bear the brunt of the Atlantic Conveyor sinking were the men of the 1st Battalion Welsh Guards in Brigadier Tony Wilson's Fire Brigade, desperate to make up the ground. Denied the Chinook helicopters vital for the forward lift of troops and materiel, the battalion was subjected to frustrating stop-and-start routine on and off numerous ships, until finally moving forward to Fitzroy on the 8th of June in the RFA Sir Galahad. Maldwyn Jones, then a Lance Corporal in the Welsh Guards Corps of Drums.
So I was sat there in the bucket list JCB, watching the crane driver, and a lot of the expression on this crane operator's face, he was a Chinese chap, he was, and pure horror. You could see it, you know, even though it was a fair distance away. Then everything sort of went into slow motion then. And I recall the crane operator jumping out of his cage and over the barrier, obviously onto the deck. And I remember seeing an aircraft flying across the ship, right above the hatch. And of course, there was no sound. To me, if it was in slow motion, there was no sound. The whole place lights up brilliantly white. Total darkness. And that's when all the sounds, and you felt the heat. Lights were off, the place was filling with smoke. You can see bulbs flickering. It was a bit of confusion. There's no panic. No one panicked. Everyone kept it cool, in all honesty. And hear people were sort of disorientated. I was myself at the end of the row of the Bergens, and I tinker next to me, a couple of other lads, and I just called people forward towards my voice and guide them to Nigel to tinker. He and I then guide them to Mike Jones, then Paul Covington, and I McWilliam, then out the ship. The company's major was letting people out the ship. And so we did that, when it seemed like for ages, and he'd be calling out and nobody else was coming, you know, and as these lads were passing it, you could smell burning flesh and that, and you could, the heat's been generated off their bodies and their clothing and that.
On deck, former Garrison Sergeant Major Bill Mott, then a guardsman, was worrying about his brother within the holds of the RFA Sir Galahad.
My brother Nick, and he was on board, so consequently I was more instantly, once I'd got over the realization that I was alive and I was okay, obviously my brother took over my mindset then. Even though I was frightened, and I was scared, because I didn't know what was coming next. Nobody did. But I was concerned about my brother and thinking, bloody hell, he's still inside. And that was frightening, and worrying about him, because I knew he was in the inner area of the landing ships at Galahad, whereas I was out, I was okay, and I was out on the deck, so I was just worried about him.
Maldwyn Jones.
As Tinker was going out, getting left out the door, I heard a shout, one of the lads shouting, help, and I says, who's that? And he says, so he said his name, and keep calling out, I'll come towards you. Went towards him and what's the matter, mate? My leg's gone. So bit of first aid. It was quite safe because he was low down. And that's when the second blast happened. That's when the sort of ammunition was going off. I thought, hang on, gotta get out of here quick now. We haven't got much time. So just basically said, there's anything else hurt, anywhere else hurt, meaning his back and his neck. No, that's it. Rapid distraction over the shoulder. And out, got him up to the upper deck. Man, there was smoke everywhere. And there's people running around trying to get things done. And we did what we could do, so to get people off into general relative safety.
And we got off this landing craft and went on the long jetty. And as we're walking along the long jetty, they said air raid warning red. And they said there's aircraft coming in again, which there was. So me and Nick are running down this jetty. We've just seen each other since the incident for the first time. And here we are now running again. And we ended up getting in a foxhole with a chef. He had an SMG. And he was the only one that had a weapon out of the... There must have been about four or five of us, maybe even more in this foxhole. And I always remember the reporter, Nicholson, but I always remember him as we were running down the jetty, he was walking the other way. Once I'd found out where Nick was, and I've always said it, I believe that it helped me because... It gave me a focus of attention, whereas a lot of blokes, when they did close down, they didn't really come back out of that. Because I know a lot of men who have suffered terribly for years from that incident, that tragic incident. And sadly, a lot of men, as you know, have taken their own lives.
They did fight and they fought well. You know, we lost 23 men and some 50 wounded on that initial part of the battle, which lasted some 12 hours.
On the night 11th and 12th of June, 3 Commander Brigade launched brigade-sized attack with 4-2 Commander on Mount Harriet, 4-5 Commander on Two Sisters, and 3 Para on Mount Longdon. Denzil Connick.
12 hours to some people might not sound like a long time, but when you're fighting in a toe-to-toe combat situation, fixed bayonets, that's a bloody awful long time. I don't think anybody really would want to see what we've seen that first morning. Heartbreaking is one word to say about it. You just had everything. You had, you know, the dead of your own dead, the enemy dead, all the sort of the mess, you know, the blooded shell dressings and equipment and all sorts, and it was just an awful moment, because in the cold light of day, as when that sun came up, you know, the sight in front of us all was just heartbreaking. They shelled us for must be nigh on 2 days. We were stuck on there suffering this artillery fire, and that was probably more frightening to a lot of us than the actual battle itself. So the shell impacted literally just a couple of feet in front of me, which blew the whole of my left leg off. Mm. So it was a traumatic amputation. And I nearly lost my remaining leg, which was almost totally destroyed. You know, it was terrible injuries, but luckily for me, there was nothing really matter above my waist. The lad I was with at the time, young Craig Jones, sadly, he died of his wounds at the regimental aid post while we were waiting for a helicopter to take us out. There was 3 of us waiting for that lift. There was only 2 that would have been able to get on the helicopter. It was only a little scout helicopter. Which the pilot bravely flew into the RAP just as it's getting dark, even though we were still being shelled right at that moment. Both the lads waiting for that lift, they died, and I was the only one still alive, even though I was triaged not to get on that helicopter because my wounds were considered so serious that I wouldn't live for long anyway. I was the only one that got out.
Favouring the advantage of a night attack, Colonel Mike Scott, 2nd Battalion of Scots Guards, delayed their advance on Tumbledown Mountain by 24 hours. Colonel Tim Spicer, then the battalion's operations officer.
And that's when we came up with our plan to do our our attack at night from the flank. But because the terrain was difficult, we had to plan it. We did a sort of Russian-style attack, attacking in echelon, one company attacking, passing the next one through, because we were attacking down a ridgeline. And then they put this attack in, and it was designed to go in, I think, an hour or half an hour before our HR, the start of our battle. And there is no doubt that it caught the Argentinians' attention. And the intent was to make them think we were coming up the road, because it was along the road towards an Argentinian position, which is why the Blues and Royals troop, who did extremely well, actually, I mean, without them, it might have been a different story, because the Argies woke up just at the wrong moment and shot Drill Sergeant Danny White. And then there was a fierce little battle. And that enabled us to get our first company really close to the Argentinians.
The diversionary attack, led by Major the Lord Westbury, was supported by Scimitar and Scorpion CVRT of the Blues and Royals. Mark Corrith.
And I decided that the only sensible way for me to go was to wing it down the road, over the top of the rise, end up with a broadside onto the Argentine company position, fire hard at them there, and then possibly put some fire onto Mount William, which was some distance away. And that was my plan of attack. I decided to lead from the front, which is not entirely what one should do. I'd done the recce. I knew where the company position was, and it was night. And the vehicles were strung out behind me. As we came up towards the rise, the sky just lit up with star shells. It was more or less daylight. And there was a DF on that rise. Boom, down came. They were going off all around us. And they could hear these shells coming in. And it was quite vicious. But then, at the top of the rise, there was this huge hole in the ground. And I stopped and looked at it and assessed it and thought, that is either 105 or 155 round, or it's a blown culvert. If it's a blown culvert, everything around it is going to be mined to bits. But I was facing directly at the enemy. And I just remember saying to my driver and to my gunner, batten down. And I was just pulling my hatch down and said, left stick, let's go down. It was a clear decision that I'd taken. I knew what I was doing, the risk I was taking. And within 2 or 3 meters, we hit a 15-pound anti-tank mine, and there was a whacking great explosion. We hit in the front right-hand side of the vehicle on the sprocket. Vehicle took off 3 or 4 feet. Corporal Stretton, my corporal horse, said that he just saw this enormous flash and below the vehicle, and as far as he was concerned, we were goners. And the vehicle, I remember crashing back down. And I was amazed to find that we were alive. I realized that I had got away with it, or at least I was alive. I called my, saw my gunner was okay-ish, called my driver, and he was okay-ish. There was quite a lot of expletives going on. And so I just calmed them down and then said, okay, grab your personal weapons and walk down the tracks as we've been trained to do and get the hell out of it. And I just want you gone. I want you as far away out of this artillery fire as you can go, and we'll try and find you later. But at that point, I then thought, okay, what should I do? So I decided to go back and bring each vehicle up to the point where they could engage the company position, and bang, 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 bang. And then once they've expended ammunition, send them back, bring up the next vehicle and the next one until we'd effectively fired our way. We'd completed our mission, but from further back than we wanted to be.
You were directing fire, not from within the turret, but on the back on the back of the turret, standing on the vehicle yourself, exposed to enemy fire throughout the entire...
Yeah, well, you know, to achieve this, and there was no time to get the commander out, and it was just a case of grabbing him, pointing at where he had to look for the enemy, and then when the shells came in, you just jump off the vehicle into the ditch, and got away with it. Thinking back on it, there was a lot of stupidity. but I do remember at one point leaping off or trying to give a fire order, and leaping off the vehicle, hearing a shell come in and knowing that that was going to be bloody close. Into my ditch, but far too late, and just receiving the most enormous amount of, luckily, peat.
On the approaches to Tumbledown Mountain, G Company would lead under the command of Major Ian Jewell Job, taking the first objective, followed by left flank under Commander Major John Kisley, and then Major Simon Price with the right flank taking the final objective. Tim Spicer.
Well, Ian's company got onto their position pretty much without a shot being fired. I mean, they were on it. They were in amongst the Argies. The Argies, I think, then withdrew because I think where Ian attacked was an outpost, an OP, if you like. And they then sat there and got quietly shelled and mortared. And then left flank, the second assaulting company, went in. And it was at that point all hell broke loose. And we realised they were not going to put their hands up. And it was going to be a fight. Plan was that we would attack headquarters. It was rather bigger than I'd hoped it was going to be, because we had, in the end, transpired, it was bloody useful. We had a naval gunfire party from 148 Battery, or whatever they're called, and they were extremely good. So we had this sort of cluster of antennas, which was a little bit alarming. But we went in right behind the assaulting companies each time. I mean, not too close, a tactical band at least, because we were conscious of what had happened to H. Jones. And you know, it was very much in my mind that the commanding officer's job was to direct the battle. And we had very, you know, total confidence in the company commanders. So, but we were there close enough to know what was going on. And we were lucky. We had four field regiment, a whole regiment of 105 light guns. I think we were able to call on 29 commando regiment if we needed to, but they were supporting three commando brigade. We had mortar platoons. We'd had a Harrier strike in the late afternoon before we attacked. And we had these two ships. And eventually, when there was a problem on the gun line in the four field regiment, the naval gunfire people did extremely well. And they put down fire from these ships. And it's unbelievably impressive. You wouldn't want to have been on the other end of it. And I think that cracked the battle, really. It was a very tough fight, the middle bit, as indeed was right flanks later, but left flanks in the middle, they hit the centre, the tough nut of the Argentinian position. And it went, you know, it went on and on. And it was infantry fighting in the pitch dark, freezing cold, amongst rocks, which are ideal to defend amongst. And it was extremely vicious fighting. Yes, I think initially the Argies had pinned the company down, and it was John's bravery, really, that he led a bayonet charge straight through the middle of their position and onto the top of the feature. And that's what broke the Argentinian defence. And it was pretty nasty stuff. Well, the final phase was that right flank would pass through them and get the last piece of the Argentine position. And I think we had some information that there was a counterattack group further along the ridgeline. And it was quite difficult to keep command and control because people were all over the place and in amongst the rocks. There were RG prisoners, there were dead bodies everywhere. And Mike was right. I mean, he then switched the focus from gaining the objective, which we'd done, was to stay on it, because as you know, that you're most vulnerable when you've done an attack is when you're trying to reorganize yourself. And that was pretty imperative that we did that. And right flank did it very well, and they were going to bear the brunt of any counterattack.
That same night, Tupara would attack on Wallace Ridge. Chip Chapman.
We knew it was near the end, and my own personal feeling was that I just didn't want anyone to die in my platoon that close to the end. Our battle at Wireless Ridge was a battle of firepower, using artillery and the CVRT, which absolutely broke the enemy will and meant that I don't think anyone in B Company fired a shot that night.
Negotiations will start tonight. Although there appears to be a ceasefire at the moment and the Argentinian forces in the Falklands have appeared to have surrendered, this does not necessarily mean that the forces in the mainland Argentine will necessarily stop fighting. Therefore, we will have normal CAP, that is air cover, combat air patrols, and we should take the normal precautions against being caught by surprise or whatever. There is a white flag flying over Stanley. Pretty marvellous.
Major Bill Dawson, 1st Battalion, 7th Duke of Edinburgh's own Gurkha Rifles, announcing to the world the Argentine surrender. But victory had come at a cost. With the problems of resupply, to quote the Duke of Wellington, the campaign had been a close-run thing indeed. Major General Jeremy Moore.
One has one's moments of doubt, and I would have thought that all human beings have their moments of doubt. One has to have the strength of character to overcome these moments of doubt. What I did not ever doubt was the quality of the man. And that, happily, I was right about.
Major John Phillips, Distinguished Service Cross.
It had to be done. Margaret Thatcher was in the right place at the right time, the so-called Iron Lady.
Robert Fox.
I was all for it because it did show the fighting ethos of our armed services.
Mark Corrath.
I think we did an extraordinarily good job. We won the regimental battle honour, which is one to be proud of.
Peter Bates.
Every single one of my soldiers had worked so remarkably hard. I had no idea when this was going to end. We realised the enormity of it. You know, it was a full-scale bloody war. And people just stepped up to the mark, and it was quite remarkable.
But the last word goes to Denzel Connick of 3 Para.
Now, had we not stood up to them, stood up to the bully, then who knows what signals that would have given to many other parts of the world where dictatorships or would-be dictators would violently take another territory. And we've just seen it all over again now in the Ukraine. So what better example of that opinion does anybody want to see? You've got to stand up to bullies. And that's exactly what we did. Never mind the fact that the Falkland Islands were British citizens, which is good enough reason anyway. These bullies need to be stood up to. And I think by doing so, who knows, we could have potentially saved thousands and thousands of other lives because we did that.
With my thanks, not only to Robert Fox, John Phillips, Chip Chapman, Denzel Connick, Peter Bates, Mark Corrath, Maldwyn Jones, Bill Mott and Tim Spicer for their help in making this programme, but all the brave men and women who took part in the liberation of the Falkland Islands 40 years ago. Here at ABF, the Soldiers Charity, we salute your courage, determination and tenacity. You set the benchmark for us, the generation that followed, an example to the world of the very best Britain stands for. A reminder that here at ABF we continue to safeguard our soldiers, veterans and their immediate families, so they can live a life of independence and dignity for the service they have given for our freedom and liberty. It is the debt we owe them. yesterday, today, and tomorrow.
Wonderful news, and it's Great Britain. Marvellous forces, every single one of them. It's just been everyone together, and that's what matters. We knew what we had to do.
This has been a Gamekeeper production for ABF, the soldier charity.